Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people who have different perspectives from me. And then we get to talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. Last week, we got to talk to Nicholas Kotar. He is a deacon in the Orthodox Church, a fantasy writer and podcaster, along with being a musician, soloist, conductor, and poet. And we talked about why it is that the fairy tale form is simply the most realistic manner of talking about the things that we know are there, but we cannot see. And maybe that is exactly why fantasy literature is such a disarming way to talk about theology. This week, we get to talk about animals, the ones that are huge and scary and need to be slain, and the ones that are in the forest and they talk to you because they can. Because the rules of how the world functions are different in fairy tales, even though maybe they reflect our world more realistically than nonfiction. So I started by asking Nicholas Kotar about two different blog posts that he has on his website. They have seemingly two very different titles, but I think they're related. I hadn't really thought about these things until I read his posts, and then I thought, oh, this is so true. One of them is about the subtle effects of making cute monsters, which is really interesting because I am currently reading a series of fantasy books with some pretty terrifying monsters. So it gave me pause and I thought, oh, what does happen when our monsters become cute? Because there is a flip side. What happens when evil is presented as being so strong that it's unbeatable?
Well, they're actually connected in an odd way. Yeah. But yeah, if we're talking about the cutification of monsters, I'm not sure if I still have the same way of thinking about it as I did when I wrote that blog post, but it's something like this, I think. Now, there's two things going on. One is monsters represent chaotic at the fringe. They represent the forces of chaos outside of what we know as familiar life. The pandemic is the monster, right? It's the dragon. Now, before the pandemic happened, we had gotten, in the West at least, in the first world, we'd gotten to a point where it was attractive to some people to think that the monsters are all now gone. And in fact, they never were monsters in the first place. They were just misunderstood. Why? Because if you tame the fringe, what are you doing? You are making it possible for yourself to think that the dragons inside my own heart are not dragons. They're simply misunderstood parts of myself. So all I need to do is to come to terms with the dragons inside myself and recast them in a different light. And in light of all of the madness having to do with the identity crisis as we're going right now, this is all connected. Because if you can't say that one person is some identity, because all it has to do is with your own personal experience of it, then there cannot be monsters, because that is an offensive thing to say, that the monster is monstrous. The monster is simply misunderstood, and you have to come to terms with it on your own. You're the problem, not the monster. So that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is that it distracts you temporarily from the very hard reality that there are dragons and that you have to defeat them. And sometimes they're within you, but sometimes they're out there. And to think about the monsters out there not being monsters makes you complacent and happy and okay with your life. So you just go through life and you just live your life and everything's fine, hunky dory. You don't bother anyone and you don't judge anyone, and everyone's gonna go to heaven and happy clappy la di da, right? I mean, except then the pandemic hit and everybody's like, what do we do? Oh no! Oh my gosh! It's real. Evil exists. And then they start blaming God, but that's a different conversation. Yeah, so it's something to do with that. It's a disturbing thing. I think we need to have scary dragons. I think we need to be aware that the dragons exist, that the monsters are out there and that they're scary, and that the only way you can defeat them is not by coming close to them and trying to understand their point of view. It's by killing them. And that includes the dragons inside you. You have to kill them too. Otherwise, they will eat you from within. Right. And fantasy does that really well, right, by the way. That's why it's so popular, I think. It's because readers recognize that, yes, these are imaginary dragons, but they do tell us about real dragons. They tell us that they are real and that you have to kill them.
So at this point, I was a little nervous to bring up a trilogy I loved, but was nervous that Nicholas would not approve. I asked about Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series, and it's true. He's not a Sanderson fan.
I mean, I'm sure he's a fine writer. Personally, I like a little more substance to my fantasy, and his writing is so transparent that you don't even notice it, which he does that on purpose. It's a deliberate choice, which is one of the reasons why it's so popular. It doesn't put up any barriers in front of the reader. It's just, you can just digest it. It's almost like you're not reading it, you're just eating it up. That's not a criticism. That's a stylistic choice.
And yet I persist with Mistborn, because there's an element in the final book of the series that I cannot forget, and I end up pondering it when I am thinking about the biblical story. This may seem like a leap, but stay with me. The thing I kept thinking about for a long time afterwards was what actually makes us human, because there are characters that he develops in this monstrous way that have maybe a faint wisp of humanity left to them, and yet they're not redeemable in the book. And that's one of the things, just kind of going back to fantasy writing, that I become really fascinated with is the underlying questions of humanity and evil, and do you have the choice to reject the call to the epic story?
No, it's true. I mean,
like on this quest, can you reject the quest or can you not?
And the ultimate question, the ultimate way of framing it is, can I, the demon, be redeemed? That is a very good storytelling question. It's one that I grapple with in my own series, because you're getting into all kinds of things like free will and fate and you know, determinism and stuff like, you know, things that people don't think about in those fancy sounding names, but do think about when they encounter sorrow and when they encounter tragedy in their own lives and find themselves in the grip of something that feels as deterministic as fate, but don't know how to get out of it. That's really one of the wonderful things about the storytelling tradition. Is that the stories have always been about the deepest and darkest realities, and they've always had a way out. Yeah, sometimes the hero dies, but in so doing, he, Prince Ivan in this case, in the Russian tradition, has to die because he can never be transformed fully unless he dies and comes back to life. And the coming back to life cannot happen by his own will. It can only happen from outside. And it is conditioned by whether or not he has made the right choices throughout his journey. And that's something that appeals to everyone. It's a beautiful thing.
Do you find, as you've been writing your series, you have a couple different series, but that there's a bigger issue or a bigger truth that you're really puzzling over and you come to a conclusion through the writing of
absolutely. A book? That's why writers write. They have some central question that they need to answer for themselves, and they puzzle it out over thousands of pages. And perceptive readers will read it, and well, perceptive readers will understand what's going on. And the better the writer is, the less obvious that question will be. And if you read my series, you'll see that in the first book, the questions are very front and center. And it puts some people off who don't like to have the questions posed in quite so literal fashion. And by the end, the questions are embedded inside the flow of the story, because I got better as I wrote, as all writers do. So yes, definitely, definitely. There's always a central question. Sometimes the best kind of fantasy series will have distinct questions for each book, but also a larger question for the entire series. And the interaction between those two levels of questions, in addition to the sort of surface level questions that each character has about his or her own journey, those three coming together and interacting with each other can make for very, very rewarding storytelling. That's what Tolkien does so well. He intertwines those individual generational epic stories, questions, in such a beautiful way that they keep talking to each other just off screen in ways that are very, very compelling.
So among all the many projects that you have one season of a podcast that is in a certain kingdom. You translate these fairy tales and read them. And I love it, but you don't have a second season.
I do. I just sent in episode one yesterday.
Oh, okay. So we're just
There was a gap. The problem was entirely technical. Podcasts don't sell themselves. So you need to find the time and the energy. Plus, this particular collaboration that you're talking about is a storytelling musical collaboration where the music is composed for the stories. It takes a lot longer, and there's sound editing stuff that happens behind the scenes that I don't know anything about. So
now I was wondering about that because the episodes are different lengths and the stories obviously are all different. And the music playing behind your voice rises and falls according to the amazing? Drama of the story. And I kept going, how is he?
I
how
have
is
nothing
he doing
to do with
that? I want to play a short clip for you so you can hear what we're talking about. A much longer segment will be at the end of the episode, and it is very intriguing. Don't miss it. This clip is from season 2, which has been released since we had our conversation. Listen to the musical storytelling that is going on at the same time as his verbal storytelling.
The gate gave way before his fingers as though it were paper. The sun shone on his head for the first time in years. It dazzled him as he stared at the hobbled forms of 3 old men in traveler's garb. Each of them held a wooden drinking vessel carved in the shape of a mallard. "Welcome," said the first of the old men. "Welcome, Ilya, to the world of the living. Come, drink of this mead that the bees themselves toiled over in their sun-drenched fields." Ilya drank deeply from the first vessel, his heart filled with joy, his arms filled with strength, his soul filled with rejoicing. The second traveler gave Ilya to drink. Ilya drank deeply from the second vessel. "What do you feel, Ilya Muromets?" "Oh, wonder! My arms, my legs, they fill with life as though they were a wineskin." The third old traveler gave Ilya to drink. Ilya drank deeply. With a group of other people, I'm very interested in the idea of the cultivation of a Christian culture that is more than simply limited to the Christian section of the bookstore. A Christian culture that the kind of Christian culture that Western civilization had tried to do and that failed. The kind of thing that calls to everyone and envelops them, not in the dead grip of somebody who's forcing you to be there, whether you like it or not, but in terms of invitation, in terms of freedom, in terms of the call of beauty. And so we put on these events, concerts, and some training sessions and lectures and things. And there was one big event that we put on in Louisville last year, right before the pandemic hit. And one of the people who had come was a very talented composer who wanted to get some training in conducting, in choral conducting. At least I think that's what it was. Natalie might yell at me later if I get this wrong. But anyway, she came to me and she said, "I've had this idea in my head, Russian stories. They're coming out as motifs, musical motifs in my head. I'd like you to listen to them." And so she had these bits of music that were completely disarticulated and not connected to the stories at all. They were just bits of music that came into her head and popped out. She had to write them down, music on piano. And so I'm like, okay, this is going to be interesting. I'm going to translate the stories, and I'm going to give you the stories, and you're going to somehow take this music that has been pre-written and has no reference to any of the story beats and somehow make it work. And it works. It's incredible.
Beautifully.
I don't know how she does it. And we did it the same thing for season 2. She wrote the music before she saw the stories. This time she wrote even more leitmotifs to give herself a bit more flexibility. And I've already heard the first 10 minutes of episode 1, and it's even better because there's more music, so she can hit more emotional notes. It's really, it's a fantastic collaborative process that is, I don't know how it works, but hey, I'm happy with it.
Well, it's extremely satisfying as a listener because of the music. You could just listen to the music and understand what you're supposed to be getting out of the story. Mm-hmm. But then you also listen to the story as something freshly translated. And yet it's an ancient story, but it still applies today. It still has these, oh yeah, I can do that. Now it's really wonderful. I highly recommend the podcast. And I am thrilled that you're saying there's a season 2.
Yes, no, there is. And for me, it was largely a question of figuring out in my own head where the priority of this particular project is. And I thought it would be something fun to do that I could just kind of do and put aside. It was something that needed to be done, but it didn't feel particularly urgent or necessary. It was just an interesting idea. And then I started to get all this feedback from people, especially from parents of young children, who were like, "This is really good. Keep doing it." I'm like, but I don't have time. And, you know, and how do I fit this into the existing projects? And I have these commissions that I have to do and translations that have deadlines to them. And, right. and this thing just has to happen, you know. And
okay.
Well, there you go.
Well, we will forgive you for taking breaks when you need to. But
thank you.
Your fan base needs you to produce these things.
This season is going to be a little different in that they are no longer straight up translations. So the season one, they were translations with, I mean, they were definitely in my voice. So they were free translations that I wasn't strict about sentence structure and things like this. I wanted to make it sound like it was me talking, not a 19th century folklorist, which is who wrote them down in yeah. Russian. This time in season two, we're doing epic poetry of a very particular variety. It's a fascinating genre. These are the Superman tales in the Russian tradition about superhuman warriors who are very human and very fallible. But the language is poetic, but it's a very particular kind of poetry that sometimes involves grammatical and philological forms that aren't strictly everyday Russian. Like you'll have expressions that repeat in almost biblical parallelism that is very, very difficult to translate. Because if you translate it straight up, it sounds bizarre and strange, and it doesn't have the resonance that 1,000 years of spoken tradition does to somebody hearing it in Russian. So I started to translate episode one, which is the foundational story of all of these. It's about the childhood of the iconic superhero. And it wasn't working. I couldn't do it. And I'm not a poet. I mean, I am a poet, but it's not something that, it's
I was
not
like,
something
wait
that,
a minute,
no,
I
no,
think
I
you
am,
are.
But it's hard. It's difficult for me. And it's not something that I can do for a podcast, which needs to happen fairly quickly. Otherwise I can't spend 4 or 5 hours doing a poetic rendition of an epic poem that lasts 20 pages. I can't do it. It's not possible. Maybe in a few decades when I have more time, but so I'm like, forget it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the story from my experience of this tradition. So these are retellings in season two. They are not translations. They are original retellings within a larger tradition. So if what I was doing in season one was showing people a light into the 19th century, what I'm doing now is continuing a tradition.
Is it a tagline? I wrote this down from your website, but I couldn't remember if it was the tagline for your podcast or for something else that you wrote where you talk about how to survive a Russian fairy tale or how to avoid getting eaten, chopped into little pieces, turned into a goat, or better see and live in the real world.
Yeah.
Is that from the podcast?
Well, I actually have a short book that's called How to Survive a Russian Fairy Tale, which is me collecting all of the blog posts that I have over the past 5 or 6 years about Russian folklore and putting it into a single volume for people who want to get deeper into the underlying structure of why things are the way they are and how they all play with each other. So that's a book that would be very interesting reading for those who like podcasts, because it gets you sort of deeper into the history and the structure of the thing.
I have a question about some of the folklore that was told in season one. There's lots and lots of animals. There's people turned into animals, animals turned into people, mm-hmm. speaking animals. What is involving an animal into the story? How is that helping us understand humanity differently?
Well, I always hesitate to get too deep into the analysis of the stories because I don't want to break them. We have a tendency in the 20th, 21st century, it's a tendency that's been growing for a long time, to deconstruct mystical realities in such a way that they stop being mystical or realities. And then they become little pieces of things that, you know, like those in Perelandra, the first thing that the possessed Weston does is take all the frogs and rip them into pieces because he's not interested in them as frogs, but as pieces of a frog. I feel like that's one of the legacies of the modern age. But I will say a few things because it's good to know. It's good to get into a sense of why people thought the way that they did. Some people will say that the fact that there's these talking animals and things is harking back to a kind of totemic religion of paganism that predates Christianity. I think there's some of that. I think there's some animism in these stories that harks back to a different experience of the world. But I think it's something that modern people shouldn't look at as a key that needs to be unlocked. I think it's very useful to see the world through the eyes of people who lived before us, and their experience of the world as having animals who can talk is not simply about taking an element of human nature that has a bestial quality to it and applying it to an animal and therefore making it obvious. that's too easy. There is some of that going on, certainly. But the experience of going into the forest and having a wolf talk to you and not reacting like that's a strange thing is central to the story. Because within the story world, it's entirely natural once you cross the border between city and forest for that world to talk to you in its own way. Because you've crossed that boundary willingly and you expect it to be strange. You expect it to be odd. You expect it to be dangerous. And it will talk to you. And you expect it to talk to you in a certain language and in a certain way. And I think there is something about that relationship to our world outside of the four walls that surround us and the windows that allow the light in that we've lost. I recently took a course from a wonderful author named Paul Kingsnorth. The course is called Rewilding Your Words, and it involved basically breaking down a lot of the barriers that we modern people place between us and the natural world, and had us doing things like going outside and imagining the perspective of the world through the eyes of a tree or a rock or a bit of moss. And it was illuminating to me. Who tells these stories? I should know that this is normal. It was still shocking to me to see the world through the eyes of the world, or to see me through the eyes of a tree. It was, and it opened up all kinds of interesting avenues into what it means to be human, because the world does speak to us. We're just sticking our ears in all the time. So I think hearing these stories where the world speaks without encumbrance to us, at least on a subconscious level, we recognize that this is normal. This is good. And there's something, there's just a lot of wisdom to be gleaned from the world.
Yeah. It is a really beautiful way of thinking of the world as something intrinsically valuable with something to say, like you're saying, instead of a commodity to be used.
Yes.
Right. And that is a place we've gotten to so much in the way that we treat the world, the environment, yeah. animals, plants around us. That
idea tragedy.
Of just letting them speak in their natural voices mm-hmm. and being patient enough to listen is incredibly beautiful. Really love it.
Well, it's also incredibly Christian, and it's so unfair that sort of narrative has been co-opted by other traditions. And instead, what everybody assumes is the Christian tradition is domination, as though we are Lord and Master, not steward, or rather king. I mean, the king of creation, which is what man is supposed to be, according to the biblical sense, doesn't mean dominator. It means one who encapsulates within himself the reality underneath him. And if the reality underneath him does not have any sort of harmony, that reflects on him, on his internal reality, on her internal reality.
Yeah.
And we've lost that. We've lost that connection of king over creation. We immediately think of tyrant over creation, but that's not what a king is.
Have you, like, with all this work that you've been doing with wordsmithing and thinking of genre and what can be communicated by how things are told, have you started reading the Bible, biblical literature, in a different way?
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. I mean, you can't help but start by, I mean, if you read and write poetry, you can't help but notice the poetic aspects of scripture. For me, though, it helps to reconnect with the biblical literature as literature by reading ancient interpretations of it. So the more I read the old fathers on scripture, and they are poets themselves, especially the early ones, the more I can go back to it and see the depth of it, see the multi-layeredness of it. Right now I'm translating a book on the parables. It's a comprehensive volume on all the parables and getting really deep into different interpretive traditions and things like this. And one of the most fascinating things I took out of that book that I'm translating is that the poetry of the parables is such that it allows for unlimited freedom of interpretation. In fact, it demands it. And mm-hmm. when Christ talks about those outside and those inside, it's not him putting up barriers between the chosen and the unchosen. It's him talking about the reality that some interpretations are going to be willfully obstructive. And it has nothing to do with him. It has to do with the reception of the listener. And I thought, wow, that is literature. That is storytelling. That is fairy tales. So actually, telling fairy tales is doing what Christ did. So that's pretty cool.
Yes. I love it. So for people who are wanting to become more familiar with your work and then ultimately become massive fans of yours. You have a Patreon page. And I know that people are supporting you on Patreon. There's your website. Is that the best way for people to spy into your world a little bit?
The best place to start probably is the website, just because it has everything I do presented in ways that are not entirely overwhelming. So if you want to get a taste of all the stuff that's going on in my very crazy head, then yeah, my website's the best place.
What is the most recent project that you're working on that you're completely obsessed with?
So it has to do with Artifact. My fellow founder, Benedict Sheehan, who is a composer, a choral conductor, and fellow madman, was commissioned to do a full-length classical music piece with full chorus, full orchestra, and storyteller. And so we created a new myth for America in musical and storytelling form. I just finished the storytelling portion of it. It's going to be insane. We are already planning a recording and a tour for 2022. And I honestly think that that's going to be something that's going to blow people's minds. So I'm very excited about it.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, but even just the hours you've spent creating worlds that invite us into difficult conversations and worlds that have those real dragons that are really scary, that kind of encourage everyone to kind of engage. It doesn't simplify or cartoonize you kind of what life is really all about. What you're doing, the stories you're telling, the efforts that you're putting into translating fairy tales is an honoring of the real lived experience of humanity, which is appreciated very much. Don't forget to listen until the very end so that you can hear that longer outtake from Nicholas Kotar's podcast, In a Certain Kingdom. As he said earlier, podcasts take a lot of time and energy to create. And even this podcast, Context Matters, is only possible because of my Patreon team. Support, ideas, and encouragement from people like Brent Emery and Kathy and Scott Parker make this podcast sustainable and commercial-free for all of you. If you want to be a part of the Patreon team that makes this happen, you will find a link in the episode notes of this show. The talented Peter Lauridsen of Sycamore Sound created all of the good sounds you hear. I look forward to our conversation next week. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you. And now I present to you In a Certain Kingdom.
But spring still came. The waters still flowed. And one morning, after Ivan left before the sun to his thankless toil, and Yefresinia was out in the fields with her husband, Ilya was awoken from a fitful sleep.
Up! Get up, Ilya Muromets! Up! Get up! Open the door to us, wandering folk!
Was it real, or was it a dream?
Up! Get up, Ilya Muromets! What shame to lie in laziness when those older and frailer than you wait at the gates! Open them!
And Ilya got up, and he stood on his own 2 feet, and they held his weight, and they even held him as he shifted into a lurching walk. The gate gave way before his fingers as though it were paper. The sun shone on his head for the first time in years. It dazzled him as he stared at the hobbled forms of 3 old men in traveler's garb. Each of them held a wooden drinking vessel carved in the shape of a mallard.
Welcome, said the first of the old men. Welcome, Ilya, to the world of the living. Come, drink of this mead that the bees themselves toiled over in their sun-drenched fields.
Ilya drank deeply from the first vessel, his heart filled with joy, his arms filled with strength, his soul filled with rejoicing. The second traveler gave Ilya to drink. Ilya drank deeply from the second vessel.
What do you feel, Ilya Muromets? Oh, wonder! My arms, my legs, they fill with life as though they were a wineskin.
The third old traveler gave Ilya to drink. Ilya drank deeply from the third vessel.
Well, what do you feel, Ilya Muromets? Oh, wonder! All my aches, all my pains are gone, as though they never were. Come back to life, young warrior. May you never again feel sickness and pain. Now go. Go, Ilya Muromets. Go to the swift river Karacharova. Bring us all a vessel of cold spring water.
And the young warrior did, bringing back a full bucket. The old travelers drank their fill, and they gave him to drink as well.
And what about now, young Ilya?
Oh, wonder, I feel the strength of 10 men in my bones, the power of 10 in my muscles.
Bring us some more of that cold spring water.
And the young warrior did, bringing back a full bucket. The old travelers drank their fill, and they gave him to drink as well.
Hell, what about now, young Ilya?
My word, what strength now fills me, the power of 100s in my blood and body. If I saw a stump in front of me, and in that stump was a ring of iron, I would pick the earth herself up and swing her around my head.
The three old travelers looked at each other in consternation.
Oh dear, we've done a bit too much, haven't we? No, Ilyusha, no man should have strength like that. Go and bring us some more of that cold spring water.
The young warrior did, bringing back a full bucket. The old wanderers drank their fill, then carefully they gave the rest to Ilya.
And how do you feel now, my warrior?
I feel half of my previous strength.
Ah, oh, it is enough, they said,
and sighed heavily.
Now, hear our words, Ilya Muromets. Listen well to our counsel. This is a God-given gift you have to do with as you will. You can use it to plow the earth or for some other worthy craft. If you wish, you may go to battle, for it is said that you will not die from the sword of a fellow warrior. But hear this warning as well. Go, fight all who dare raise arms against our mother Rus. Never start a fight with Svetogor the Great. Mother Earth herself groans under the weight of his walking. Don't pick a quarrel with Krasnayar, for his lot is it to smith the fates of men. Never raise a hand against Mykola Silyaninovich, for Mother Earth loves him as her own. And whatever you do, steer clear of Volgav Seslavievich, for if he cannot best you in strength, he will outwit you. And if he cannot outwit you, he will down you with cunning.
And so saying, the old wanderers disappeared. Were they even there in the first place?